Well, I don't like being taken. Perhaps you don't either. Too many times, a charming voice greets me when I pick up the phone. And then, within 30 seconds, I'm being sold something I don't want. I get uncomfortable when on the street, or truth be told, here in our own building, somebody I don't know comes up to me and asks me for money. Sometimes I sit with someone for 30 minutes, and at the end of a long story, all that is being asked of me is money. At all times, I try to offer a caustic, non-hospitable, response, though sometimes I'm rehearsing the words in my mind. Do you know the feeling? At other times, I've felt guilty and forked over that 5 or 10 or 20, even though earlier in the conversation I had said I would not be able to give any money. Maybe you can relate to this. Maybe you feel the same way I do, confused about the issue of poverty in our society. Confused because, indeed, in a democratic society in which everyone is given a certain amount of opportunity, we should all be able to make our own way, right? At least, that's what I was taught. But then I, perhaps we, remember that many people come from non-supportive families, maybe have experienced abuse, maybe have turned to drugs in their pain, maybe are struggling with mental or emotional illness. Maybe we remember incidents when our laziness or our incompetence or even maybe a willful misstep wasn't punished by a firing or banishment or worse. Recently, President Barack Obama became the first sitting president to visit a U.S. prison, and he said very self-revealingly and honestly that he had just met men who were in prison for mistakes that were very similar to the ones he had made as a young man. One imagines that was President Obama's way of admitting that he'd experimented with drugs as a young person. Perhaps we feel guilty about our own defensiveness. Perhaps we wonder, how does God feel about it all? What is the correct approach to poverty? Or since that's such an abstraction, what might it mean to treat the poor we do meet with the hospitality of Christ? The suite of texts assigned for this day, the 15th Sunday after Pentecost, expose this story at a very precipitous time in human history. This is a hugely important issue in our lives and society. And of course, I use those words purposefully. This is an issue and a theme that unites the story of Israel and the worldwide church because it unites the First and the New Testaments, as our readings today demonstrate. The few verses that are drawn from chapter 22 of Proverbs are illustrative of chapter 22 as a whole and might be titled When Rich and Poor Meet. The first two verses call us to remember that both the rich and the poor have the same Creator. This is the reality of all of our lives, regardless of our station in life. It is this reality that informs all that comes next. The next two verses drawn out of this chapter help make a very important political point. That though God has created all humans, both rich and poor, it is not God, just as truly as it is not often the poor themselves, that determine their station. Rather, it is the case throughout human history that the rich determine the economic rules of any society. As our text says, the rich rule over the poor. The borrower is the slave of the lender. Wow, that's as true of the modern world, isn't it, as it was of the ancient one? It is the privileged who set tax codes, create the tax exemption loopholes, etc. That doesn't mean that those rules are always unjust, but it is important to remember that these rules are set from a certain perspective. We see how this works its way out in progressive societies like Canada and the US, where every 50 years or so there is a spasm of social conscience and the marginal tax rate is set higher. Then, over the next decades, we see those marginal tax rates get whittled down by successive political leaders who know that one surefire way to get elected is this promise: I'll lower your taxes. The third little couplet of verses drawn from our first reading talks about what happens when the afflicted are crushed at the gate. The gate of the city in ancient Israel was the symbol of welcome, of business and trade, of safety and sustenance. If a society persists in ignoring, further dehumanizing, or refusing to share with the poor and the afflicted, that society in return will soon be itself exploited and afflicted. Because that's just the way the thing works, but also because the Lord is emotionally invested in crafting justice for everyone. These words, then, in our first reading and from Proverbs, are not to be read deterministically. They invite us to work out the implications politically and economically. They do not prescribe one right way of dealing with the issues in our society. They do not tell us which party to vote for instance, in this election in the fall of 2015. But they do challenge any easy equation between our actions and our financial state. Things are more complex, they want to say. There's more good luck in the lives of the wealthy than they're often prepared to admit. And there's more misfortune in the lives of the poor than the simple equation that claims they haven't worked hard enough. Indeed, both Israel and the church made sure to focus on actions towards the poor as a test case of faith and faithfulness. Christian faith cannot be reduced to our actions of social justice, that's for sure. Our worship, our study, our prayer, just loving and learning, the way we treat people every day, those are as important as how we treat the poor. But if we do all of those other things well and mistreat the poor, we have not understood what following Jesus Christ means. And that is, of course, the point of our reading from James chapter 2. And how relevant James's letter sounds on September the 6th, 2015. Yes, of course, it's relevant because of the grave refugee crisis this week galvanized around the picture of little Alain as he washed up on that beach in Turkey. And yes, it's relevant because of the occasional homeless person wandering into our services. But it's also relevant for our congregation as is. Not every one of us finds enough to eat in our fridge every week. There are poor people in our congregation. I know it doesn't seem possible, but it's true. There are some of us who look forward to coming to a Sunday service because of the goodies that are offered afterwards. As a community, we are called to be aware of these sorts of needs. This requires the difficult but important question, how are you doing, really? It requires honest questions and honest answers. It requires those of us who are in need in whatever way, physically, emotionally, to make our needs known. Sometimes I'm put in that awkward position of finding out about a need after the fact. We may have been able to help, I may have been able to help, but nobody knew. All of this requires humility, both on the part of the asker and on the part of the helper, which brings us to the remarkable gospel reading from Mark. And here I must say is very good news indeed. Jesus' response to the Syrophoenician woman could be helpful, I dare say, to our own political process around refugees and poverty, just as I think it can help us with our own dilemmas and choices when it comes to helping folks around us. Often Jesus is portrayed as knowing something before it happens. This fits with our picture and sense of his divinity. God's divinity is one of all-knowingness, being reasonably in control of all things. And so we project that onto Jesus' humanity. Often Jesus is portrayed, even in our Gospels, as knowing something before it happens. But here, in possibly the first of the Gospels, we have a story that reveals something quite different from this classical understanding. Here we catch Jesus in a kind of halting mid-step in his thinking and in his speech. And the author of Mark has dared picture that open space of dialogue where ethnic pride and prejudice come to a fork in the road. We see Jesus confronted by the equivalent of someone of a different religion and language coming into the middle of our service and asking for help. And Jesus' first reaction, of course, is the relaxed and familiar, "Of course, we'd love to help. I'd love to help. What is it you need, ma'am?" No, it's not, is it? It's something far more uncomfortable than that. Something far more like the defensiveness you and I may feel, but try not to say when accosted by a panhandler or someone who dares intrude on our well-planned life. He asserts Jewish elitism, echoing the lines of the Pharisees towards Gentiles, and especially the poor Gentiles. It's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. But astonishingly, the woman responds, not by admitting that she is one of these dogs, but with a saying that ties deeply into what God has taught Israel about how to live with the poor and the alien refugee in the midst. "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Mark's gospel is famous for its use of the Greek word euthus, which means immediately. Immediately, Jesus went here or did this, etc. It's as if Jesus knows he has limited time and things better happen now or not at all. But here, in this story, the phrase that is used is not "immediately Jesus said to her," but "then he said to her." It smacks of surprised pause, of interruption, of learning, recognition that the kingdom of God is calling for a change of mind. You have here, then, the quintessential reality of God's new commons. Not in some abstract economic theory, but how it actually works its way out as we're confronted with a person we haven't planned for. Eugene Peterson translates this moment with, "Jesus was impressed. 'You're right,' he said to the woman." Now, if it works this way in the Son of God, how much more so in our own learnings as we stumble through our days? If the Son of God goes through a process of learning to cooperate with God's ways of love and justice, of overcoming traditional prejudice and elitism, now that is actually fabulous good news for us. Whether we are confronted with someone asking or even demanding something of us in terms of material or emotional need, or if we're thinking more globally about the refugee crisis, the biggest since World War II, the Spirit of God allows for room. Room to think. Room to respond. Room to change our mind. And then room to adjust our thinking and our planning. Two of those adjustments I want to highlight. Two quick examples. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, grew up in a Lutheran pastor's home. She's a practicing Christian, but known to be quite conservative economically. Recently, she has changed her mind on how she thinks Germany should treat refugees. She was famously filmed, videoed, telling a little Palestinian girl that she wasn't welcome in Germany. Now, Angela Merkel and Germany are helping the nations most influenced by Christianity open their hearts and pocketbooks to the refugees, seeing it as a new opportunity, a fresh opportunity for the world to come together, for nations and peoples of different faiths even to help each other. This morning, I awoke to the news of Pope Francis calling on every parish in Europe to sponsor one refugee family. A powerful call to action and service in line with his papacy. I wonder what St. Matthew could do in partnership with a couple of other parishes, possibly deanery-wide, or maybe with another church or two here in town. You know, we've been given room to think about that, to change our minds if need be. By the Spirit of God, by God's Son Himself, showing us how to do it. So don't be discouraged by that defensiveness you feel, even by the hidden prejudices that may be exposed in your heart when you encounter somebody from the street, somebody who's down and out, maybe thinking about some of the needs in our congregation. You know, that's how learning happens. That's how the Spirit of God draws us into the kingdom of God. That's how love and compassion and justice grow. That's how each of us will find ourselves, as we follow Jesus, doing our part and finding ourselves coming to that place where, with the crowd in our gospel reading today, we say, "You are Lord, for you have done all things well."